First case in our calendar is 97-2005, R.J. Weiss Development Company versus the Board of Zoning Appeals. I think counsel are not here yet, so we're taking the second case, is that right? And the second case, 97-2046, State of Ohio versus Lord Palmer.
Why don't you just submit the first case? You should do the submit. Can we go to just what you said? You don't think there's much disagreement, or I'm trying to recall now the words you just used about the Court of Appeals opinion. Is this case in conflict with any other case?
Yes, it would be in conflict with Wilson and Bowen.
Okay, now if there's no disagreement about what this Court of Appeals opinion is this not driven on a factual basis as opposed to being a proposition of law?
No, Your Honor, this is purely a question of law. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear. What I was trying to say before, if you refer, I believe it's to page 5 of my merit brief, there is a chart on that page showing how days should be assigned, whether it's to the state or to the defendant. And what I was meaning to say, according to page of the court, is the Court of Appeals did not disagree with this chart in terms of if a Bowman analysis is used, then these days are correctly counted in that chart. But the Court of Appeal disagreement was the analysis of Bowman.
And that's why I'm wondering whether or not, because, you know, we've had these speedy trial cases time and time again for years and years and years. And we get to the point where it's a factual question of whether or not was it really on the docket, the continuance, and who is it charged to? And in this case, why should it not be charged this period of time to your client? And didn't the Court of Appeals, when it said that it should be, isn't that not really in conflict with the other Court of Appeals who said it shouldn't be?
No, Your Honor, it's absolutely in conflict.
Okay.
This case is a case concerning the tolling of speedy trial time as a result of a competency being filed. And quite specifically, in the 12 district cases, they explain how you go about calculating that tolling. The 11th district, although the reasoning isn't so clear in this case, it refers to prior cases from the 11th district where they articulate how they calculate it. And there are two places they don't agree. The first place concerns the first proposition of law and when does the tolling start. Clearly there is a tolling, and we're not arguing that there's not a tolling. But the conflict exists as to where the tolling starts. The 12th district cases basically say, and these are reported cases that started coming out in the early 80s, basically say that the tolling starts when the trial court orders the competency exam. The 11th district and certain other districts say no, the tolling starts when the defendant first files a motion for a competency exam. Your Honors,
isn't that what starts the process of determining pursuant to 0.72 the defendant's competency and filing the motion? Isn't that, says of course, as you know, competency stand trial is being determined. That's the language that gives us the trouble, is it not?
Yes, it is.
Why is not the filing of the motion by the defendant asking the court to determine my competency, why is that not the beginning of the determination? Otherwise, there would be no determination. Is that correct? It's the defendant's burden to raise the issue, isn't it?
Yes. Well, the court could do it to a spot.
Court could, sure.
But yes, the defendant has a burden to do that. If they have a problem with it, they certainly did do it here. Your Honor, I'm not going to try to see the court. The answer to that question is not as more easily obtained, as easily obtained, as the answer to the second proposition of law. I think you have to read these statutes and pair them periodically with each other. The reason I think that the tolling should start when it's ordered, when the exam is ordered as opposed to when the motion's filed, is because unlike, and the state here cites many, many, many cases which all deal with insanity pleas, not competency motions, certainly. Unlike insanity pleas, when you're looking purely at a motion to determine competency, the trial court does not have to order an examination at all. It can just simply hold a hearing and rule. That is what actually happened. And in many cases, that's not what actually happens. But that's the answer. My answer to that question, Your Honor, is the trial court has discretion as to whether there's going to be an exam at all. Also, Your Honor,
why, counsel, though, why wouldn't the 72, the .72e be the answer to that question as well, that it says time will be told from the time of any motion filed by the defendant? Why doesn't that just answer this question?
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect to the court, I don't think that's quite what that statute says. Actually, that statute is not that simple. That part of the statute, Section E, talks about delays resulting from a motion. So first you have to have a delay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you go on record and find that there's a delay and everything's reasonable...
What's delay? I suppose...
Delay means delay.
Right. Is in this case, the court has to, the proceedings have to stop until this issue is determined, the competency to stand trial. Is that amount, is that not what the statute envisions as delay, or is it something else?
No, Your Honor, actually, I wouldn't agree that the proceedings have to stop. Certainly, a trial cannot start.
Right.
I would agree with that. But the fact that you can't pursue discovery and do other things is simply not true.
Preparation, in the event that the defendant's not competent to stand trial, every other effort that's being engaged in would be for naught, correct? Because if indeed there's a determination that the defendant is not competent to stand trial, then anybody who does a lot of discovery and hires experts and does that kind of work, it would be a waste, wouldn't it?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. In fact, we instruct our people to pursue those avenues because if, in fact, the defendant is finally not competent to stand trial, that doesn't mean that the defendant is going to never be found competent to stand trial. And I think it's important to gather that sort of information and do those types of exercises as soon as possible. And I think in order to exercise diligence, you're well advised to keep going with the case. Certainly, you can't start a trial. Certainly, you can't have any type of proceedings where the defendant is obviously very involved, perhaps a suppression hearing of some sort or something like that. But
so this would be your reason to say that that this wouldn't fit 72E in terms of delay?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, I think when you look at 72E, in my opinion, it very specifically is thinking about speedy trial. And there are all sorts of things that you can do within your 90 days or your 207 days, as the case may be, and never get to the 90th day or the 270th day. I think when you're getting to that point that this delay comes in, this concept of delay, and that goes along with...
I didn't follow that. Delay comes in only near the end of the running of
For example, it only matters. For example, in your suppression cases, there's a tendency to take one line out of an old decision. I apologize, I don't remember the Judge Sullivan's decision, which in effect says that, you know, while this thing's pending, speedy trial time is told. I think if you read some of the other cases a little bit more carefully, you'll find that it might be told. Because you can't have a motion for a suppression that doesn't result in any delay. Everything keeps going on. You eventually have a hearing. There's eventually a ruling. You're within your 90 days or within your 270 days. There's no reason to hold anything.
You're asking our indulgence on this because courts really haven't read it the way you're advocating it today, have we?
Or appellate courts. courts have recently noted, no. Pull out the one sentence and don't look at the underlying rationale. But there was an underlying rationale. Mm-hmm. And also, Your Honor, I think, and I want to get to this point before we leave. First of all, with regard to the first proposition of law, in this case, it may seem somewhat insignificant because we're really talking about 5 days. I can assure the court there are cases out there that are pending that involve a period of 90 days, 120 days, between the time that the motion to determine competency is filed and a competency exam is ordered. Now, why on earth would you toll 120 days because the trial court decides not to grant it for 120 days? The statute says the trial court's got 30 days to determine competency. If it orders an exam, then this whole other set of, this whole other time frame kicks in.
But isn't it the obligation of defense counsel to make sure that that is done?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because if you read the statute, it's and cases that
are you don't want your client sitting there day after day after day and nothing being done. You mean you don't have any obligation to get to the court and say, listen, you know, time's running. When are we going to get this done? You just sit there and let it run?
Right. That's what the Ohio legislature said, yes. It's made very clear.
But you have no obligation to get this process moving, you feel. You just let it sit there as a defense attorney.
Well, there's a difference between obligation and what I might do in practice. Well, legal obligation, no, there's none imposed by statute. The statute does impose an obligation upon the trial court to make these things happen within a time frame. And that's the big distinction between this case and the insanity cases. Quite clearly, the legislature has differentiated between an insanity plea situation where there are absolutely no days, for lack of a better term, provided, and a competency situation where the legislature quite specifically provided days and provided mandatory language shall. In this particular opinion, I guess there's a small disagreement between myself and the state about what the 11th District's position even is, because at one point in a prior case, they had said that these days are mandatory. The mandatory language shall is used, but then they concluded that they're ministerial and have nothing to do with speedy trial, and I'm not quite sure what that means.
Well, that's the point I was getting at originally, because they really have not been clear on that in their own two cases. And do you think there's a conflict within the 11th District itself?
No, I don't. I think that they're mincing words a little bit, because when they read the statute, it says shall, and it's clear. And there's nothing else in the statute. I mean, basically, shall has, in other contexts, been interpreted to be not always mandatory. I agree. But that's always when there's something else in the same statute that tells you the legislature didn't mean mandatory by shall. Here, there's clearly nothing in the statute that tells you that. And so the 11th District didn't want to say the shall isn't mandatory here because it is, they said it's ministerial. And here again, I don't know what that means. I mean, to me, a ministerial duty is a clerk filing a piece of paper when you hand it to them. They're saying essentially there's no connection between the two. I would submit to the court, if you carefully read those statutes, there's a very distinct connection.
But the interesting thing is they're not, that 30-day requirement is not a statutory speedy trial requirement. It's not in the speedy trial statute. Now, your argument, you haven't gotten to your second point. I don't know if Justice Douglas was finished, but you're into your second argument now. It is not a statutory speedy trial. A defendant may have a Sixth Amendment argument regarding if there were an abuse of that 30 day, and you know, paint the worst horrible scenario that it's somebody sitting in jail for a long time and in violation of the 30 day and the 10 day or the 10 day. But I'm not sure your argument flies because it is not, you're making a statutory speedy trial argument.
Yes.
Ohio law, and we got the statute. And that is not the statute upon which you're relying.
But, Your Honor, in other contexts, this court has looked to various other statutes mm-hmm. in interpreting the speedy trial statute. And in fact,
to interpret the statute or to interpret speedy trial rights under the Sixth Amendment?
To interpret the statute. Okay. And in fact, Your Honor, basic rule of construction this court's always followed is that any time you're talking about any dispute with speedy trial, it's strictly construed against the state. And if, you know, just a general basic rule of construction is that all statutory terms passed by the legislative act have to be given some effect. I would submit to the court, if these 30-day and 10-day time periods are not read in conjunction with speedy trial, they're absolutely meaningless.
Well, they...
absolutely meaningless.
It may...
yet, they've been codified time and time again. Every time the statute's been changed a little bit, mm-hmm. those provisions have been kept. And it's been changed, I believe, three times since the Bowman case came out of court, since the Wilson case came out of court. All these other cases are unreported. The legislature has been quite aware of what the 12th district has done, has obviously been satisfied with it, and has again, in Senate Bill 2, Senate Bill 2 basically took these statutes and rearranged them and renumbered them, and did change some things. But in terms of the issues we're talking about here today, nothing was changed. The 30 days and the 10 days were all kept in place. Your Honors, I would also like to point out that if you look at the speedy trial statute, I am referring to the speedy trial statute this time, the rationale for the 11th district here is real. And I agree. Sometimes these types of examinations simply can't be completed in 30 days. It's true. But the speedy trial statute, I believe it's section, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm sure opposing counsel will, but I believe it's section G, says that speedy trial can be told for any reason, so long as it's reasonable, put on the record, and I hear it's happened. So the 11th district's fears have already been dealt with by the legislature. You order a competency exam, 25 days down the road, you find, hey, I don't have a report. 30 days down the road, I don't have a report. We got to get everybody in here, go on the record, see what the problem is, cure the problem, and then we will continue it for a reasonable amount of time. None of that was done here. Why was none of that done here? Because the trial court knew it didn't have to. In fact, Your Honors,
give you your time, Mr. Carlo.
Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
State of Ohio in this matter. And from the time that I wrote this brief, I've been trying to think of a clever analogy to bring to you as to what I think the 12th District did when they came up with the decisions in Bowman and Wilson. And as clever as I can get is to tell you that I think they took 2945-71 and 2945-37, which are actually parallel lines, and tried to make them intersect, which they do not. They do not have anything to do with one another, and when these opinions came down, that's exactly what the Wilson case did, was it forced a meeting of these statutes where simply none does not exist.
Does the trial court have the discretion to deny a motion for a competency hearing?
For the hearing? Yes, the trial court has that discretion.
Okay. If the trial court has the discretion to deny a hearing, then the motion could be filed by the defendant, and the trial court could sit on that for an extended period of time and then deny it, and the defendant be credited with no time even though he's incarcerated, she's incarcerated.
The operative word in which you said, Your Honor, was could, and clearly that did not happen in this particular case. This whole matter was settled within less than 2 months, the filing, the granting of the motion, the competency hearing, and the decision all came down in less than 60 days.
So we're writing law not just for this particular case, but for the universe.
We understand. Yes.
And what it says is, or during which his mental competence to stand trial is being determined, is a pending motion which can be denied a determination, a pending mental competence determination. There isn't anything being happening during the period of time the motion's pending, is there?
Well, other than the fact that the trial court is obviously trying to weigh various facts and come up with a sound decision, there is nothing happening typically with regard to the case itself.
Well, not the case itself, the mental competency of the defendant. Let's limit it to that. If there's anything happening with regard to the mental competency of the defendant, is there?
No.
Okay. Then why should we not just construe those words as they're there, or during which his mental competence to stand trial is being determined?
Oh, absolutely. I believe that's what the 11th District did in this particular case is. He put the trial court on notice October 6th that his competency, he may be incompetent.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, just as the portion of the statute which you just quoted, his competency then is under consideration, it is under determination, and therefore the time should be and is told.
No, what's under consideration is whether or not the motion is going to be granted.
Correct, but, well, his competency in general is under consideration, even at that point, Your Honor, because he's putting the motion before the court. He's putting the question before the court, and there's a determination to be made. Even though we may not at this point have a psychiatrist or a psychologist speaking with him or trying to come to any kind of conclusion in that type of action, clearly, though, the trial court, as I said earlier, is trying to weigh various factors as to whether or not this needs to proceed to the next stage. So that's why I would argue for the state that the moment that the trial court is put on notice, be it sanity or be it competency, that the time at that point should be told. And that can even be done.
Yeah, I know your argument, but again, during which his mental competency to stand trial is being determined. So you're saying the motion itself is ancillary to, or part of at least, a determination of competency.
Absolutely, that's my argument.
So when a trial court denies the motion, does the trial court say, I find him to be competent? Or when the court grants the motion, does the court say, maybe he's not competent? Or does he just grant what the statute says for us to do, grant a mental competency hearing or the examination pre-trial?
Your Honor, I believe in the practical sense that when these motions are made, typically a trial court, at least in my experience, and I did do some trial work, is to follow through and go ahead and grant the motion, first of all, and number two, order the psychiatric evaluation, finally hold a hearing, and then make a determination. It would be very unusual if that particular scenario did not unfold.
But it could happen. I think that's their concern, because that, you know, I've seen that happen in cases that I've handled years and years ago, I admit. But you file that motion, and sometimes it languishes. And when it languishes, you want to go to the judge and say, move this along? Not if you're the defense lawyer, and you think it's being told you don't want to do that.
Well, that's
or that it's not being told.
Sorry. That's an interesting point that you raised about the defense counsel's obligation in all of this. Even the Wilson case, which by and large I have a disagreement with, but even the Wilson case itself says that the defense counsel should be alerting the trial court to this situation, that this is the case. And that is certainly within the purview of the defense counsel to go before the trial court if, in fact, you use the word languishing, yes, if that's in fact what's happening, it is certainly part of the defense counsel's duties to bring before the court and say, let's get things rolling, what's the problem here?
Have you ever been on the other side and want to walk into a judge's chamber and say, hey, you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing, and press a judge?
Well, sometimes, Your Honor, as the state of Ohio, we are put in that position, whether we want to be or not, and it is not a comfortable position. But and I think another thing too, Your Honor, you put that in terms of the trial court being the problem, and very likely the trial court is not the problem. Perhaps it's the fact that the forensic center cannot schedule the evaluation. You don't have enough people to do it within 30 days or whatever time frame you want to have it. I have seen frequently where it is the defendant himself who becomes uncooperative with the process.
Yeah.
And will not grant the interviews or will not answer the questions as he or she should. And that causes a problem. So it is not really the trial court, per se, the crux of the problem in that you have to go in and ensure success.
I see problems if we were to adopt the appellant's argument in the fact that I think we would end up with a lot of violations of the speedy trial rule. I'm looking for almost a bright line test, and I feel that the filing of the motion would be that, and it would be fair in all cases if we were to wait until the judges are to rule on this request. We would have so many different time frames, and how would you as the prosecutor know whether the time was running or not? Do you agree with me that it would create some problems if we were not going from the date the motion is filed?
Yes, it can, and it does, Your Honor, because we are under the impression as the state that, in fact, everything has to be
Because you can't proceed with the trial, I mean, while this motion is pending, whether it's going to be granted or denied, the trial cannot proceed. As defense counsel said, you can proceed with discovery, etc., but that doesn't help the matter as far as what the purpose of speedy trial is. The trial cannot proceed.
No, Your Honor, in effect, everything is suspended, and we wait for whatever ruling there might be in this situation, and it is not practical. Since, as you were saying before, if we end up with several different timelines and time frames,
nobody's going to know where you are. From the date that motion is filed, you won't know really what the time frame is going to be.
No, you really won't. And it all depends on how quickly the reviewing agency, or examining agency, I should say, would be able to see the defendant and make interview him for her, and write a report on it, file that report. There's no way for the state or the trial court to control those factors. It is beyond our control. And that's why the state does argue that the moment the court is put on notice, and I would even argue that this would be an oral motion. If the trial court is put on motion, given an oral motion, that I'm going to question my client's sanity or his competency, and we would request that the examinations proceed, and that they are put on notice even orally, that speedy trial time should be told. Because that's, in effect, what's been happening in the state with respect to sanity motions. Since the Walker case, these motions are typically made orally as opposed to in writing at first. Now, very often, they are, it is a practical matter, backed up with the filing of a written motion, but very often they are oral motions. I would simply point out also that the 12th district's position is not a particularly popular one amongst the appellate districts, and I know that that's not your function is to decide popularity here, but I would point to the 8th district, for example, who's rejected their findings in the 12th district, referring to the language in 2945-37 as I believe it was directory rather than mandatory was the words the 8th district used in this particular situation. As has already been stated by Mr. Partlow, the 11th district found the language to be ministerial with respect to the 30-day requirement. And I would simply wrap up by saying again what I started out with. There is nothing to indicate in the statutes that there should be such a sharp intersection of these two particular provisions within the Ohio Revised Code, the 30-day rule, if we can use that term, and the 270-day rule that says that they must come together, and that once you have gone past that 30 days, or give us another 10 for the hearing, that once you've gone past the 40 days, you're running speed, and that should be charged against the state. These motions are made by and large by defendants themselves for their benefit, and as a result then the state gets slapped with being caused to dismiss indictments and what have you. It's speedy trial time runs when we are, not we, but of course the trial courts grant these motions and allow these examinations to take place.
I guess I wonder, why wouldn't we assume that all these policy arguments would have been made when the legislation was adopted? I mean, 30 days with trial court to hold a hearing, we have the written report to be done within 30 days. Don't we assume that the General Assembly, when it adopted this legislation, had before it the arguments of the time arguments and the problems that would be raised, and that they concluded that, General Assembly concluded that 30 days is shall conduct the hearing? That's a reasonable period of time within which to require these events to occur. Why do we argue the policy arguments here? Why should we consider the policy?
Well, because what has apparently happened is we have two different interpretations of what the Ohio General Assembly did. Certain districts, well, particularly the 12th district, feels that once you hit that 30 days, you're supposed to go to charging that time against the state. Other districts, such as my own, the 11th district, argues instead that, no, this is a ministerial thing.
Well, I know the arguments. I guess I'm asking you, why should we not assume that the legislature, when it uses the word shall, means shall, that that's exactly what it means. It says the hearing shall be, it could have said may, could have given lots of conditions under which the court could have made a different decision, but it says there's some reason that the General Assembly, seems to me, the General Assembly wanted these proceedings to move quickly, and that if they didn't, the state gets charged.
Well, I would disagree with your statement, Your Honor, because of the fact that it was not written into the 30-day rule that once you let this time expire, then you're going to go back and you're going to charge this time against the state. Also, we still have pending in 2945.72 the fact that any time the defense files a motion that causes a delay, which these do, and the arguments were made earlier that they don't, these do cause a delay. They cause an absolute suspension of the proceedings in order to examine the competency and come up with a report. And for those reasons, I cannot explain why the legislature did not make themselves more clear on that. That, Your Honor, I cannot answer for you. But what apparently this court is going to have to sort out in the policy argument is whether or not just because we have a shall provide or shall file the report in 30 days, that means then that once you don't do that, your speedy trial time is right. And that is not clearly in the statute. It's clearly not there, in fact. Well, if there are no other questions, I'd like to conclude my remarks.
Thank you, Ms. Annis. Mr. Carlo, you've used your time. It may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honors. The only thing that I guess in 30 seconds I would say is...
Unless you're saying you don't want to take 30 seconds. But
no, I apologize, Your Honor. The only thing I can say in 30 seconds is I understand some of the policy arguments that have been made, but I think they really go to the wisdom of the statute rather than the letter of the statute. Now, this Court's taken great pains in the past to enforce legislative enactments, such as Senate Bill 2. If one-tenth of that effort is used here, then I believe the only result that can be reached is to follow the 12th district.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.